listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host for the most, Nikki Kolula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very talented singer-songwriter all the way from Austin, Texas, New York, Bay Area as well. Is that right? Did I get all three?
Yep. You got right. LA, New York. I lived in Austin a while, lived in San Francisco, originally from outside of Pittsburgh.
Amazing. And what's your favorite out of all those places?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. They're favorites at different chapters of your life, you know?
That's a smart answer.
It's a very political answer, right?
Well, we're going to introduce you, Miss Emily Zizek Holmes. Isn't that correct? Did I say it right?
Well, that's the legal name, but for artist purposes, I am Emily Zizek. So.
Okay, Emily Zizek. I apologize. I know her as both. I know her as the Superman and the Clark Kent identities.
There you go. We like to keep them guessing.
So I just read your bio, and what's super cool is we have a mutual music friend in common, Mr. Tim LaFay.
Yep.
How did you meet Tim LaFay? I love that cat. He's one of my favorite people.
Well, I met Tim through my producer in Brooklyn back in the early 2000s, Josh Kessler, kind of was producing my record, which became the 2006 release, You Had Me at Goodbye. And cool. He put together the band. So it was Tim, it was Keith Carlock.
Wow.
It was Josh on guitars. We had Dan Menceris on keys. We had strings. We had all sorts of stuff. It was very big production. And so from there, Tim asked me to be part of this side project he was in called Boomish, which was like a live drum and bass outfit with Zach Danziger and, why am I forgetting people's names?
Not the Wayne Krantz project that he was playing with.
No, that was something separate.
Okay.
So I did one live, they did like a staging of Boomish as sort of a kitschy 60s variety show, and I was in part of that, and then from both the experience in the studio for my record and from that, we did a couple of records together that were sort of more experimental electronica. The first
That's
one
awesome.
Was Domestic Blitz in 2011. And the second one was the project with Gary Novak called Angelinos, which was 2016, I think.
Wow.
So,
That's
yeah.
Amazing. What amazing, like what fortuitous luck and just kind of fate to cross paths with him and work with Keith Carlock and all these crazy musicians. What was that like? Let's talk about that.
Well, thankfully, I was kind of stupid. So, like, I was just like, oh, that's cool. Like, Josh knows these guys. He's putting together this great band for me. They're all super talented. Like, I never measured myself against them because I didn't really know their pedigrees, which was beneficial in the process of making a record. And it was my first real studio record. So it was helpful maybe not knowing all of that and not being like, oh my God, well, these guys are like so much more established and like, should I even be like working with, you know, like all the stuff that people do naturally.
Right.
But thankfully I didn't know any of that. So I just went in like super cocksure.
They probably respected you more because of that. That's probably a good thing that you didn't know all the things that they were doing at the time, right?
Yeah, for sure that helped. I mean, as you work with people, you know, you kind of like, oh yeah. The biggest thing I had noticed was just like, oh, we just go in and do it, you know? Like,
yeah.
I've played with so many people where they're not like your regular band, and so it's always a little like, you're kind of like playing the adjustment game until you kind of hit the lock. And these guys, you just go in and they just lock. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, like, Yeah, where like Keith and Tim play together so much, or had at that point, you know, they were already there.
Right.
So I got really lucky. And, you know, and Tim and I have just become really good friends over the years. You know, we've seen each other through a lot of crap and a lot of good stuff. And I'm so happy that all the things that, you know, not befell him, but that he'd been working toward for so long, like really happened for him, especially with like the Bowie Black Star thing. I mean,
I mean, it's just so, and he didn't even know that that was going to happen. He just got called to play in like the record. And then David Bowie just happens to be there like, hey, I guess we're all going to do a record together. It's like, what?
It's crazy.
I
never really dig too deeply on like the background of that. I've heard a couple stories. That's all I need to know. That's his story to tell, you know?
But it's, I just find it so interesting because, you know, like David Bowie's last record, he was still kind of innovating and still kind of like digging deep. That was what was like super inspiring. He was so inspired by jazz musicians. He right. just wanted them to go and play. And I told Tim, I said, man, what an honor that he was just like, go in the tracking room and play. And let's see what we can come up with. I mean,
yeah. And like,
that's so crazy.
What was the second single off of Black Star?
I'm terrible with the names off. That
I know
record.
I am too, but it starts with Tim.
Right.
Like doing right. that solo bass thing. And I'm just like,
yes.
I would know that in a heartbeat. I've worked with him so much. I was like, that's Tim LaFay. You know,
so
you
Tim
just know how he sounds and
yes.
his tone and
he's got a feel.
The choices.
He's got a
yeah. He's so musical. And yeah, he's a true talent.
He was playing with my drummer for a little bit. And that's how I got connected with him. And he played bass on one of my singles, Fade Away.
Oh,
and
cool.
he just... And it was so cool because it was the last track I needed bass on. And I was like, hey, man, I want you to play bass on this. And we met. And, man, he just nailed everything in like 1 to 2 takes. It was like such a fast session. And then we just hung out and talked. And it was just mm-hmm. like, this guy is so good. And then he got the Tedeschi Trucks gig.
Yeah, he was like, on that for a long time, too.
It was just amazing to see him doing that. But I really respected him, like, also walking away from that project. A lot of musicians would have just stayed. And
sure.
Like,
it's easy to get golden handcuffs,
yes,
you know, when you're that
yes,
good,
yes.
But he's constantly innovating, and what he
that's
does what sonically as a bassist as well. I mean, he's very musical. He's very innovative, but like what he does with sound and texture is really unique as well. So he can kind of transcend a lot of different genres and just easily slip into the groove or like, easily make like the out dissonant stuff, you know,
well, let's talk about your process. Tell me let's go way back first.
Okay.
Tell me what that moment of zen was like for you when you knew you wanted to be a songwriter. Was it a song you heard on the radio? Was it a music video? Was it a family member or a friend that, you know, showed you music? What was it that made you fall in love with music and know that this is what you wanted to do with your life?
Well, I remember singing from as long as I can remember. I remember starting to write songs as early as 10. And I was gifted a small acoustic guitar by, I believe it's my grandmother. The story got straightened out for me. I thought it was my aunt, but it turns out I think my grandmother got it for me. And it was one of those things, like I had it, I played around with it for like a week or two, and then it went in the basement. And then like a year and a half later, I rediscovered it, and that's when it stuck. So I started taking lessons, and I was simultaneously like obsessed with the Beatles for like 2 years of my life, where I listened to nothing but the Beatles.
That's like not a
That is education is what that
yes.
is.
Yes.
So the way my guitar teacher instructed me, he was like, pick out a songbook, and what we'll do is we'll pick a song, we'll review it, and then you have the week to learn it on your own, and then you come back and play it again. So, of course, I got, like, the complete Beatles. And I already knew the tracks. At that point in time, I was listening to the cassettes on Sony Walkmans at night, like, with the mono mixes.
Yep.
And, like, hearing, like, dissecting the production in my head in the dark, which I think is a really good way to both listen to music as well as if you're dealing with a lot of body issues, because I found this to be the case with people I've worked with, like healers. Like if you are in a space that is less stimulating, particularly if it's dark and if it's quiet and if you don't have other people where you're feeling this little like on edge, and you can truly relax. You can usually, at least, I don't know, I shouldn't say this, you can, but I can kind of pinpoint if I'm having pain issues, like where they are, how to like if I'm going to try to do some sort of like pressure point work, like I'll know where to find it easier because I can just de-stimulate the environment and like really hone in on whatever it is I'm trying to locate. And so I used to do that with production, you know, like listening to Beatles records, I'd be like, okay. And like, and then I'd rewind it and I'd be like, did I hear that correctly? Or what is that? You know,
like the layering of harmonies or the guitar lines. And things totally. Like that. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was like a huge thing for me at that time. And at the same time, I was starting to write music while I was learning guitar and learning all of these Beatles tricks. So it all started around, you know, I guess, you know, I guess at that point you're an early teen.
Right.
And then I just, there was no real place to play where I grew up. There was no real, and there was no real support structure where you could say like, oh, I want to be a songwriter. I want to be a musician. Right. I was like, oh, I've got to find some way to get out of here because there's no future for this idea that I feel like I need to pursue. And if I did have to stay there or go somewhere else, I needed to find some way to support myself so that I could keep doing it.
You know, what's crazy about that is like you grew up, you said you grew up outside of Pittsburgh and it's like, you're so close to New York City, but you're so far.
Not really. You're 7 hours away from New York City.
Well, but I mean, you're close and you're not at the same time. You know what I mean? Like, meaning like you're closer than LA is to New York and yet you're not because you're just, it's far away. I mean, like 2 hours is enough of a distance where you're not, but the reason I'm bringing it up, it's like people should be exposed to like there are career paths with music that make sense. Right. But sometimes in those like, you know, smaller cities or even like, you know, blue collar cities, there's just like, that's the lifestyle. So an artist being in that environment.
Well, it was also like, I was like a really good student. So like my parents are like, why don't you get a job being blah, 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 like things that you have the ability to do and will give you a guaranteed financial security, you know, like a lot of parents will say to their kids. And so there was this inner conflict for a lot of years of like, I don't know, like that you actually can do this. I had no examples of it. So I couldn't say like, oh, that person does it, you know?
Right.
And it wasn't until I really got to New York the first time after school that, after university, that I started.
Where did you go to school, by the way?
Syracuse.
Oh, awesome. So you were in upstate New York.
Yes.
Then you went to the city. So you made a cool transition. You went to upstate to get the schooling and then you went to the city because you're like, this is where the action is.
Well, there's nothing in central New York. I mean, I shouldn't say that. That puts down the area. But for what I wanted to do, there wasn't much one could do. You'd have a short leash, you know what I mean? And I went there for media studies. So like I had done every kind of internship I could do. Like there's a newspaper, there's a radio show, I work for the local affiliate, you know, like all these sorts of like things to test out, well, where do I land? You know? That's why I went to school for that, because I was like, I don't know that you can make it as a performer, but this feels like very close to performance that might pay me a check. So let me study that and figure out where I belong. And then I found out after doing all that, I was like, I really don't belong here either. You know, I've got to take a leap of faith.
Isn't it weird that it's like you can dance around it, but it's like, it just is the passion and the drive of what it is just keeps growing inside of you. The more you're even not doing what it is that you really want to do, which I find super interesting because it's like, I actually went to music school. I studied opera and I was like, okay, this makes sense. And I lived with all jazz musicians and it was like, oh, I don't want to do opera at all. I want to write songs. I took a songwriting class, changed my life. And it was like, it's like I was in the environment. I was around the people and yet I was still like, this is not it. This is so close and yet so far away. So like I can relate on that level of like, you know, you're trying to do something that looks good on paper, looks good on, you know, in books, but really it's not.
We're just like, I want to live in an apartment. I got to figure out how to pay the rent, you know?
Yes. Yes.
And like, I never had like the long string of jobs that a lot of actors take on. Like I didn't, I wasn't a good bartender. I wasn't a good waitress. Like I could easily slide into like corporate, what's the word I'm looking for? Like temp gigs. Like I could be an executive secretary. Right. I could jump into like a PR firm and like navigate how to like do this and then ask for opportunities like, hey, I want to try my hand at writing the press release for blah, 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 you know?
Right.
And those were people too that I understood because they, you know, a lot of the people there I met were like, they were smarter kids. They spoke like about things that didn't seem out of reach of my like mental capacities and they were willing to take a chance on me. So that gave me confidence. But also what I didn't understand at the time was it gave me this true practical foundation for skill sets that I would end up having to do for myself as an artist down the line.
You mean like organization, things like that?
Press releases, or, reach out to press, how to pitch a story, how to edit a story. Like I'm terrible in the sense that I'm always like sending notes to people who do like reviews. I'm like, I'm really sorry, but I used to work as a writer and an editor and I need to point out these two, like two or three issues with this review. You know,
that's awesome.
Can you please revise it? No, I don't know that it's great, but you know, it is what it is. So there's that. I mean, it's really helpful as far as the PR marketing side of things.
But that's an important part of it.
Oh my gosh.
That's like one of the most important parts of it.
I'm sorry, my daughter's frogs are like croaking like crazy. I said, what is that noise?
That's awesome. That's my dogs are like at my feet and right now they're kissing each other. I'm like, okay, there's harmony, but yeah, they're making funny noises too.
Yeah, but these things almost sounded like a car in the street, but like you were stepping on like a rubber duck or something. So what is that noise? I never heard them go off like that. So, well, maybe the frogs will make the broadcast.
But, no, that's all right. That's all right. Live art. That's what we were talking about, right?
That's right.
So did you start performing in New York? Did you start like recording?
A little bit. Tons the first time. The first time I lived in New York, which was like 96 through 97, I did a couple drop-ins at like Sidewalk Cafe and maybe a couple other open mics. But at the time, I was doing more writing and I worked in indie film, like on production. Awesome. So I did that kind of stuff. And then when I got to San Francisco, because then I moved there in 97, and I had a whole bunch of experience. And I had more like recreational, like people who would jam, you know?
Right.
And they weren't like pursuing music as a thing, but they always would play or whatnot. And I was like, oh, huh. And then I went through a big breakup and a couple friends of mine who were jammers, like took me out to some open mics. Cause like I was scared. I hadn't picked up the guitar in a long time. I hadn't written in a long time. I got on the stool like to play and like my arms and legs were shaking cause I just wasn't comfortable there.
All right.
But after
This is in San Francisco.
Yes. Yes. And like, I don't know. I think this would have been 98. And then because I went to enough of them, like I could always sing. That was the one saving grace is like, I knew I could get up and even if I messed up all the chords, I knew I would be able to like hit the notes and probably sing in a powerful way. So that was lucky for me. But because these were really supportive, I got my confidence.
That's
or maybe
awesome.
I don't know if I got it back or if I got it the first time. And then I started playing out and then I started bands. And then I started like thinking, and at the time San Francisco was at the first .com rise and fall. So as a writer and an editor, you could kind of like pick up work, not work full time, being someone who does these things and knows enough about HTML to like kind of skirt into like the basic level of a liberal arts degree, you know, that could get you paid. And there was so much money that everybody had cheap rent and like were getting overpaid for things. And there were all these launch parties with money. So like I used to ride a bike in San Francisco. And what I would do is I would just follow the spotlights that would mark where the grand opening party was. And I would like ride there and talk my way in and like eat for free.
That's awesome. Well, it's
it
like
was scrappy, you know.
Artist, but see, there's something when you're doing that like now I'm sure you feel like it's you don't need to do it now, but there's something scrappy about it that I miss when you're like, oh, there's a hunger to get into that room or into that scene or whatever that now you don't probably have. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not the same because you could probably get in a lot easier. You know, it's like,
yeah.
It's like I, now I buy great concert tickets, but I used to sneak into those same sections.
Right,
there was a
right.
Much bigger rush.
Like, oh, someone has a way to the floor. You're like, all right, let's do it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. So, like there's something about like the juice is worth the squeeze when you put in that kind of like daring energy to it. So mm-hmm. I'm sure you were in this really cool artistic environment where it was like helping you to propel those artistic endeavors and also the social aspect, because, you know, as a performer, it's kind of like you have to also be socializing and networking and trying
for
to like,
sure.
You know what I mean, that's
that was another benefit of the Bay Area, because the world in which I lived, because I didn't have a car, so I didn't move around tons. I was like, if I can't ride my bike there, I'm not going.
Right.
There was this sense of like a real try to become the big fish in the small pond feeling.
Right.
And it's funny because I've met other musicians who were there at the same time and like our scenes did not overlap at all.
That's
so,
funny.
You know, people I probably should have met at some point, or maybe I was just oblivious and I was just like, no, my friends are the coolest. I don't have to pay attention to you. Like I got my thing, you know?
Never know.
And once again,
did you ever know of a band called Tea Leaf Green by chance?
I knew their name.
Okay, so then I grew up with two of the guys in that band.
Okay.
They kind of started making a scene in San Francisco. So,
right.
And then they would tell me what the scene was like. So it's everything that you're saying. It was like all these different music movements where it was like
yep.
Singer-songwriter, jam band, there was like funk, there was like rock, there was, you know, kind of all these different scenes, but they all didn't really overlap, which I'm like, that's kind of cool and crazy at the same time.
Yeah, it is. It's crazy to me because I was like, this town is not that big. You know,
right.
Like,
right.
It's like, I should know more people. And it could have just been like, I fell in with a couple of tight friend groups who they already had like their scene worked out. And so I was like, all right, well, in a way it's a little bit lazy, you know, like you'd fall into these friend groups and you're like, I don't need to get outside my comfort zone because I already have a comfort zone here and a comfort zone here. And that covers me. I'm good.
Right.
Hang tight for just a second because I
no
feel
problem.
Like I'm going to turn on my overhead light because I feel
yeah.
Like I'm in a spotlight.
You're like, it's about to go dark in here.
There we go.
All right, let there be light.
Back in my ear. All right.
Let me ask you this. Did you start recording in San Francisco? Was that around the time that you started making records?
Yes. And it was kind of indie. Like we went into studios, but we weren't dealing with like super, it was like a band. I joined a cover band and then I joined another cover band and then I ended up joining an original band or became half of the songwriting team of an original band that
That's
was
cool.
Like my thing for a couple of years. And then I sort of have dalliances where I do a gig under my own name, but I didn't do tons. And then it really wasn't until I guess I moved to New York that I was pursuing more of my own stuff under
like
my
own songwriter thing. Did
yeah.
You play like, I remember playing the Cutting Room, which is no longer there.
Yep, I played the Cutting Room.
I don't think the Living Room was, I don't think I played the Living Room, but the Living Room I think is either
well,
still there.
Which
or
one? Because there were two of them,
right.
You know?
Rockwood, I think Rockwood Music Hall was a
yep.
Big one I played. That was a cool venue. That's probably one of the coolest venues. And now that's gone.
Yeah.
It's sad to see how some of the scene in New York has changed so much. You know, so many
it clubs. Is. It's weird. The couple times I had been back in the last 10 years or so, I always played it at Rockwood. So now
yeah.
I don't even know where I would play because all the rooms I used to play are kind of gone. I guess,
yeah.
Is piano still there?
I think piano's still there. I think I played a Russian bar called Drum that I think is still there
yes.
In Brooklyn
mm-hmm.
And like just a bunch of random rooms. Hey, fill
yeah
out.
there's other rooms too. I mean, I feel like Pete's Candy Store is still around in Williamsburg.
Yep.
There's a couple other rooms over in Williamsburg that are still around, and there's new rooms too, you know. There's a lot of cool new rooms. Like there used to only be like two places to play in Red Hook, And right. both of them are now gone. But now there's new places like Jalopy, and there's other ones that are like either deep Red Hook or parts in Brooklyn that like are just cool spots. And yeah. I don't know, because I haven't lived there since like 2011. So
what did you think of the music scene when you were there? What were you thinking?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. You know, I really went deep. There were a few years when I first got there where I was playing pretty regularly, but then I started going real deep in like 2005. Okay. It was simultaneously around the same time that I decided I wanted to make like a true studio album. And I got connected with Josh Kessler through friends of mine who I did a collaboration between, like, it was a house song that I ended up writing. And
So that record you did with Keith Carlock and Tim was your first studio record, like, yes. as a songwriter? Wow. That's crazy. That is yep. ridiculous and kind of awesome.
Like,
and
I said, because I was stupid, you know, and it was good that I was stupid, because, you know, otherwise it could have. But, you know, the other thing I have to say was nobody tried to mansplain it. To me, right. like nobody was like, oh, well, you should do this. Like right. nobody did that. And thank God, because it could have like completely colored the experience for me in a bad way. Yeah, right. totally.
Right. Yeah.
And I took chances on that record that maybe I wouldn't have necessarily. And I like that record a lot for that reason, because it's one of the more it's not a straight up songwriter thing. It's got like too many good players and too many experimentalists that like encourage me in a way to like jump off the cliff, you know?
What's cool is my drummer was roommates with Keith Carlock. They both went to UNT, and I think Keith was a senior when he was a freshman. And so mm-hmm. he used to listen to Keith practicing, and he was just like, man, this guy's like such a badass drummer. And he was like his favorite drummer, like for the last 15 years, something like that. So
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I knew so much about Keith Carlock because of my drummer and all the people he played with, like Steely Dan and Mayer mm-hmm. and so many other people. And then, you know, I heard that Tim LaFay, Keith Carlock and Wayne Krantz were doing like yep. a trio gig in New York. Like, that's what I love about New York right there, is like, you have these heavy hitters playing every week at, like, you know, like the what is it?
Bar 55.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's like, what?
And that I think the Wayne Krantz thing was at the Bitter End, no?
Yes. Yeah. I think it was at both. I think they started the Bitter End and then it went to Bar 55.
Yeah. Because I mean, like, that's how, like, so he crazy. Got, Tim got hooked up with, what's his name? McCazin.
Oh.
Who did the Bowie thing.
Oh, that's how they got connected?
Yeah. They were doing wow. Bar 55. And the story is that whoever was working with Bowie had heard about this combo and had told him about it. And we're like, these guys are great. They play together all the time. They've got a lock. And I think this is what you want. And so wow. either they filmed and showed Bowie or whatever. And that's how that whole thing came about. So
how did you feel like the songwriter scene was, like, you going, you know, kind of like you're doing this record with Tim LaFay and Keith Carlock. Mm-hmm. You kind of played the scene a little bit. Were you thinking like, this is a very songwriter friendly city, or were you thinking this is a grind, because it is not easy to be an artist in New York, because there is a lot of competition, you know? Like,
that is a good question. I think I thought that when I was going to make a studio album with these like heavy cats, that like everything was just going to work out. I was going to get like a label deal and I was going to like do really well, because a lot of people I knew were part of that first wave of songwriters. A lot of people got signed out of like Sidewalk Cafe and Shanae and all that stuff. And you're like, it's just a matter of time. It's going to happen. Like, that was sort of my mentality. And, you know, so many of those people did get deals, but then, you know, then dropped, you know, like so many songwriters, like, got these great deals and then they were just dropped on their second or third album.
I was just having the same conversation with one of my engineers, and I was telling him, I said, when I came into the scene, everybody had a development deal with Interscope. Everybody mm-hmm. was signed to William Morris. Everybody was signed to some label deal, publishing deal with Warner Chappell. they all got dropped. And like, because like I never went that route, I was like, okay, I'm gonna have to do this on my own. And I got into bigger rooms. I got into bigger festivals. I did it on my own, made those contacts on my own. So like, at first I was like, oh man, this is such a curse. And now I see it as such a blessing, because I probably, if I had signed a deal with any of those labels or any of those publishers, I probably would have been dropped just the same. And then I would probably think, oh, I can't do this on my own. I need all the things, you know, the manager, mm-hmm. the agent, to kind of make things happen. So I'm sure you probably went through the same thing. Like, you were like coming out of corporate America, like flirting with corporate America on some level, or getting gigs, being an artist, knowing the professional side and having a network. How did that affect like just you doing it yourself and making things happen on your own and just kind of networking and making things happen?
Well, I have been a freelancer my entire life. Even when I worked in corporate situations, I was always freelance.
Okay.
I haven't had a full-time job like ever on staff. So already that puts me in sort of a different category mindset. Like, I was okay with not having the health insurance and the predictable paycheck on time. I was like, that's cool, man. I can work for a bit and then I can like save the money and then I'll go do something and I'll come back and get something else.
Right.
So that was helpful, because a lot of people don't like that and feel very uncomfortable in that setting. So I didn't have that to work against me. And then there were all these like weird opportunities in New York, like doing jobs you never even knew existed. Like, I have an entire back career as a fit model, which people don't even know what that is outside of the industry. They're like, fit model, like you did fitness? I was like, no, I worked with the production side of a design house to help fit their standard size and give feedback on the fit so that they can make changes and then size down and size up accordingly. So I learned whole side of like, and I had kind of been around fashion. I'd worked in fashion retailing at malls. You know, it was something that I enjoy and right. was right. around. But then I found out about this sort of a gig through working at the art and fashion schools as a drawing model. People told me about this fit modeling. He's like, what's this fit modeling stuff? They're like, well, if you can keep your size consistent, like it pays really well. And, you know, I was like, okay, I can do that. So I got, you know, in with an agency and I got some steady clients, and that was how I could afford to pay a band, because I had a couple standing clients where like, I'm like, okay, I know I'm going. The only thing it was a detriment to was whenever I was going to go, when I started going abroad to tour, I had to always keep it within a 10-day to 2-week allotment, because if I went more than that, like I could lose my client, and then I was like, oh, I'm not gonna make that money like working a bar gig.
That's kind of like my favorite amount of time to tour. I kind of like, it's enough time where you're like, oh, I get a taste of the road and I can come back.
And then you don't come home to like a 2-foot tall stack of bills.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It got to the point where I was like, why am I even living in New York if I'm always going on the road? Because I was doing a lot of domestic touring, like out of my car, and I was going over to the UK a lot. And then at a certain point in time, I don't remember when this hit, maybe to 07, 08, I was like, you know what? I'm going to live in New York for a change. I'm going to play in New York. I'm going to live in New York. I'm going to like take a break from touring. So I stopped doing a lot of the other stuff and really focused on New York. And at the same time, or slightly thereafter, I said to myself, because I had been doing, like, I was in a couple other cover bands, so I was keeping these crazy hours between that and like the schools and the fit gigs. I was just sort of like, I'm burnt. So I decided I gotta look into this sync thing, you know, where it's like, I need to get on board. I need to get like, there's songs, they're well produced. There's something they could totally start working for me and on like the back end. It's like having an investment portfolio. You're like, right. I've got these stuff. I gotta start making it work for me. And yeah. So I started networking in those communities, going to like music supervisor, like meet and greets, and going to Guild of Music Supervisors Festival out here and things like that. And just really trying to network that side. I mean, by the time I got really invested, the price point for entry for indie artists had kind of stabilized. Like, I love it when these people are like, you know, a sync license can be like 10 grand up front. I'm like, I don't know who you're talking to, but if you're an independent songwriter who's never had a label deal or whatever, but still has a product that's commodifiable, if you want to call it that,
right, like,
those aren't the entry numbers, you know? Like, I know what they are.
Because it's like, it took me a long time. I started like $1,000 syncs, and that was like a big deal. And, you know, it took me a long time to get to the bigger ones. And it's like, mm-hmm. I still like the smaller ones because you can get more of them. But
yeah,
the bigger ones are, but like, I mean, people were talking to me about like, oh yeah, there's $25,000 syncs and $80,000. And I'm like, I've never seen any of those because
yeah, exactly.
A lot of that's connections, labels, agents. It's all
totally.
Of
I mean, like everything. And right. This town is the worst for it. It's like right. The biggest smoke and mirrors game you're ever going to play is in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So wake up, Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right. That's the reason, that's the name of the show for a reason.
But yeah, it's, you know, you try to stay positive because it's real easy to like get down on things if you start like playing that game, you know, and you really want to be, you want to be in the good space, because if you're living in a negative space all the time, you're putting out that energy, you're going to attract that energy back.
Yes.
And, you know, I have turned down opportunities because it involved people whose energy like really put me off. And they could have been like growth opportunities, but I was like, no, I don't want to deal with that person every day. Like, I'm too old for this shit. Sorry. Yes.
No, you can swear. I swear all the time.
Oh, okay. Okay. Didn't know. Sorry. But yeah, it's like, I don't want that around me because I've worked a lot of years to remove so much of that out of my immediate life and to build a security, you know, whether it's privacy or it's how I want to live my art, how the opportunities I'm going to take advantage of, the steps I'm going to take. Like, some people be like, why don't you tour more? Like, you don't have a baby.
That's like a question that somebody that's never toured asks, though. You know?
Well, some people live for the road and can't live off of it. You know, it's like people who are soldiers that come back and they're like, yeah, I got to re-enlist because I can't work in this framework. You know,
yeah, but then those people also end up sometimes getting divorced. They end up like their home life become like,
maybe it works, but maybe it's not the way you wanted it to play out. You know, you don't know. And you have to kind of figure out your path based on your choices, because every one of those choices has a consequence.
Right.
It's going to be beautiful things and there's going to be not beautiful things. And you just have to understand your role in it. You know, and
well, it's interesting to see all this because it's like there's this big post about life on the road going, like, it's all over Facebook, it's all over the social media about like how hard touring is. And I'm like, man, I agree with all of this stuff. And a lot of bigger artists are like, you know, posting it. And I'm like, imagine if you didn't have guitar techs and roadies and touring like that. Like
that is your support network.
Well, that's real touring. That's like, when you're doing that, like when people are like, oh, the road is tough, but they have guitar techs, they're living in buses and they've got roadies. And that's a very cushy way to tour. I'm like, that's not the way I tour. I tour like very streamlined, like very, like we're going to festivals. I'm driving, you know, the band to the festival in a 15 passenger van or two cars, or we're, you know, like we're there and doing it, but it's like, we're loaded.
Or on the flip side, you know, like I tour a lot on my own. So I spend a lot of time by myself and I have to learn all the stuff, you know. I had to like, okay, pandemic was good for a lot of reasons. Like, I got my studio up and running. I got, you know, over the course of time, I was like, all right, these are some pieces of gear I need to get, because for me to do these other things, I need them to be flexible and, you know, and just do the work sometimes. Like, yeah, I could kind of sing certain songs, but I'd like flub it here or there. It's like, all right, well, do the work, learn it, make your book, you know, get organized, do the promo, do the outreach to like radio, or find, you know, the other big thing about the PR component is like, know where your music fits, even if it's not the way you see it, how other people might categorize it, and then find the other artists. Like, approach them to do shows together. Find out who's playing them. Approach those DJs. Say, like, hey, I know this person. I got this record release. I think you might dig it. Can I send it to you? You know, like, just don't be afraid to take the chance, you know?
I love that. And you just finished the record. Let's play something from this record. What do you want to play first?
Oh, goodness. What did I send you? Well, you have a couple videos that were actually made. And then you have some other songs from the EP. It's an EP. It's 6 songs. So,
artist choice. Your choice. What song do you want to play?
Gosh, I hate that.
I'll choose the next one. Fair enough.
Okay. Okay. Well, then I'm going to pick an unlikely choice, I think. I'm going to pick Between Midnight and Memphis, which is a song that came out of a title that I had for a few years before the song was even there. And I worked on it with Ted Russell Camp, kind of like trying to
find it. Wait, Sam just says we don't have that one. Was that one of the YouTube links I sent you?
I thought I sent you all the YouTubes, and I did send you MP3s. I think it was the one that was attached to the email. But if you don't have it.
Yeah, we don't have that. That's what Sam just sent me. He said, we have the 6 YouTube links that you sent me.
Which one of them it should be? Well, maybe it didn't get on that one. That's fine then. I'll send you the link through the chat in a second. Okay. Yep. What do I want to do now?
Send me one of the first 3 that you sent me.
All right, we'll just pick this first single. How's that? Because that has a video. Okay. The first single is a song called Love's About Taking the Fall.
Great title, by the way.
Thanks. It is, it's in line with my thinking on the whole EP. It was very much crafted with a theme in mind, that idea of like getting to a place where you're willing to take chances because you know who you are and what you want. And who you are and what you want is a summary of like all the things you've done along the way. This is sort of like a mature woman perspective versus like if you listen to younger songs of me, like it's sort of there's a bit more of turning over your power, which I think a lot of young women go through in the journey to become who they want to be. And this one is from a very different perspective. It's like, this woman owns her power. This woman's like, hey, this is what I think we're going towards. But at the same time, I need you to step up. And if you can't step up, like, it's okay. Like, I'm going to be fine. You know, like that's sort of, it's a different perspective. It's a shift. Like you kind of know where you're coming from and where you want to go to. And you're not afraid to ask for it. You're not willing to settle.
Love it. Well, here it is. Love's About Taking the Fall by Emily Zuzik.
Don't leave me hanging, that's wrong. a chance or I may lose belief.
Grooving, just a
thanks.
Great pocket, just bluesy, good rock, awesome, awesome. Tell me what the influences for the song and style. That tell me what kind of seeped into your song.
Okay, so I was on the first trip, sort of outside my house and trails during COVID, early 21, and my family went up to Cambria. And in the central coast of California, and we stayed at this place near Moonstone Beach, and I brought my guitar along. So one day it was like getting close to sunset, which was always stunning, and I was sitting out on the porch, and I was just sort of like hammering on that A, and I was like, I want to write something that's kind of like the Pretenders. And so that was just a loose idea. Like, vocally, I think that's sort of where it was going, like, I was channeling Chrissy Hynde. And, you know, and then I just sort of had this kind of simple bluesy song. And then, how to get the story? I think I wrote the first lyric, and the chorus wasn't totally set. Like, I think I knew it had to have that note. I was like, that's the only way it's going to pop. And I wasn't sure what the wording would be yet, but I knew kind of where it was going. But the first kind of verse was sort of in a state that was close to what the first verse was.
Yeah.
So then I, you know, I worked on the second verse, and the bridge was sort of, we knew there was going to be a solo. And as it kind of came together, it was like, I need a saxophone solo and I got the guy, you know, sort of thing.
That's great. And, you know, kind of had like a, it had like a Melissa Etheridge meets Sheryl Crow. With a little bit of like Twist of Springsteen with that sax solo. It's like, you know, I have a saxophonist in my band, and I really love that you add a saxophone solo, because there aren't a lot of saxophone solos.
Exactly. I was like, think of all the songs that had sax in them in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like, we kind of got spoiled in like the late 70s. And the whole point was with this, like, whereas Torch and Trouble was very much more an Americana, it was more steeped in country, it was more like vintage outlaw country, and it's drawing from influences. This one I very much wanted more of like a late 70s to early 80s New York rock feel to it.
Very cool.
So it was grittier, it was more like basic songwriting, it wasn't like drawing necessarily on country elements, and it allowed me to get punkier in some places. And
well, it really brought out your voice too. Like, it brought out the vocal. The groove is still echoing in my head, mm-hmm. and your vocal is just digging in the whole time. That's what makes awesome. It awesome.
That's so nice to hear. I love getting feedback like that.
No,
how
really,
you listen
really cool.
and like what hits you, you know?
Well, for me, it's like, I think I love hooks, especially instrumental hooks, riffs, like things like that in songs. When I hear that in songwriting, I'm like, oh, this is going to be good, because it sets the tone. And then when the melody is just as good as the instrumental hook, I'm like, oh, this is just catchy. It's just catchy music. That's what I love. It's like you got to build.
Hey, listen, man, when you're born out of your songwriting is born out of the Beatles, you're kind of set.
Yes.
You know, you can listen to the Sex Pistols and you can listen to like real minimalist stuff. But like, you usually go back to an A, B, A, B, C, A, B, you know?
Yep. And it's also those arrangements were just so accessible and so smart because mm-hmm. they were simple and like fun to listen to. And that's what made them good. I'm going to choose the next song. I want to hear Trouble because there seems to be something of a story just in that title alone. So here's Emily Zuzik with Trouble.
Hi. Today, we're going to make some and the bad. See the way your hair gets away in the wind, across your face and out of place again. Can't get it off my mind. Coming closer, what am I to find? Don't feed me that line. Your game's as good as mine. It's never gonna be straight up, you know. Something's gotta give, something's gotta change. Wouldn't you walk away? This mystery I see just fills me in more every day. And this ain't no puzzle you could crack. A monkey on your back. Just you and me, baby, trying to find a way. I'll feed you the lines, but I won't leave you behind. It's never gonna be straight up, you know it.
That song fucking rocks. Like, you need to play more stuff like that. I'll tell you, I have like a thing. Like, I love when women play songs like that because that you're doing it like Black Crowes style and you're doing it better than the Black Rose. So you've got to do like that, because there's something that is so like invigorating, empowering when you see a woman rock like that. It's like, you got to do more of that. It's such a great sound. What a great sound.
Thank you very much.
You please do more like that. We're going to play another song. I want to make sure we play a third before we, run out of time. We're going to play Easy. Tell me a little bit about this song before we play it.
Okay, it's the first song off the new EP, Agent Alchemy. We have managed to not play any of the moodier stuff. We've only dealt with the rockers.
Love it.
And this is, I like to call this the story of my life. It kind of takes you through the different chapters. It talks about living in the Bay Area, it talks about living in New York, and it talks about living now and how the perspective has changed. And it's also, the original EP name was going to be Easy, which is a play on my initials, Easy.
Okay.
But also sort of like an easier approach to life and like letting go of things, the themes that you'll see throughout the EP. But then I changed when I got the title that I liked more. So anyway, this is Easy.
Here we go. Here's Easy by Emily Zuzic.
$650 square foot apartment on the corner of 2nd and A. Above and on a bodega, the M15 bus route and a rock and roll fashion runway. Shots from safe position where the ladies did their business at night. Would grab a big ass burrito, ride the bike to Sausalito, and take the ferry back to the city lights. Groove into that heavy hill beat.
Songs, because these songs rock. You need to play more.
Well, it's cigarette writer, rocker mom. You know, that is my tagline. It's there for a reason.
You got to write more songs like this, because that sound is amazing. Where can people find you if they want to find your music online?
www.emilyzuzic.com. You can find it on Spotify. You can find it on Apple Music. You can find it at emilyzuzic.bandcamp.com. I sell it at live shows. I got a show coming up on June 7th at the Hermosa Beach Fine Arts Festival. There's a pier stage. It's music on both Saturday and Sunday. I'm Saturday. It's at 1 p.m.
Awesome.
And I'll be playing with Ted, not full band, but Ted and I will like bring the duo rock.
That's
and
cool.
Yeah, and there's I've got channels on YouTube and you know stuff.
You're on all the platforms that you have to be on, which is
yes, exactly. Happened. Instagram at Emily Zuzic, you know, Facebook.com/Emily.Zuzic.music. Yeah, all of them. I'm not on Twitter. I quit in protest on Twitter.
Yeah,
on Twitter, but.
Me too. I don't think I've ever really been on Twitter ever, but. We may still
it's
have
funny.
A camera,
there's a lot of radio people on Twitter. That's how I met a lot of people when I was trying to promote stuff a few years ago.
Yeah. I never got into it. But you know what? You're on all the other platforms. Emily, we'd love to have you come back and
Thanks.
Remember the songs you played because I want you to come back and play some more rockin' songs. We may be able to put in some brooding, moody songs on the next time. But check out Emily's music. Thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. On behalf
Thank
of
you
Sam,
for having me.
Of course. On behalf of Sam, myself, Emily, Rufus, and Miles, we'll see you guys next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Peace, love, and
Henry.
Bye.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood and Eddie Pence right here on LA Talk Radio.